last time on The Night That Changed Rock.
You know, there'd be a scatter shoe there, and you're like, well, that's just one shoe.
She went up to the nurse, and she described Steve and the look on the nurse's face.
He looked, and he goes, it's her. And I thought, oh, it's her on the phone. And then I looked at his face again, and I'm like, no, that he means.
This is episode 4 of The Night That Changed Rock.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man.
And then we handled it really badly afterwards. We just handled it really badly.
WHO manager Bill Kerbishley encouraged the band to keep moving forward.
They then started to have a discussion with me about what we should do about the next day, what we should do about the next shows, etc. And I said to them, look, I really felt that this was a little bit like being in a plane disaster and then never getting back on a plane again, you know, a fear of flying. So I really felt that if they didn't play another concert, they may never play again.
I believe we handled it really badly. What we did is we left the city, and we shouldn't have done. In fact, when the same thing happened to Pearl Jam in Denmark, in Enniskillen, where a number of people were crushed in the front of their stage, I got Eddie on the phone and I just said, stay there. Whatever's happening next, cancel it, stay there. Just fucking stay there. And they did, and I think it meant a lot. Because what happened with us is we had a show the next day in Buffalo. So we spent the night, we couldn't sleep, we got drunk, we sobered up, we got drunk again, we didn't know what to do, we didn't have anybody come and talk to us, we really didn't know what to say or think or feel. And then we got on a plane and we went to Buffalo. We ran away is what we did. I'm sorry, but that's what happened. We ran away. You know, we had an excuse because we had another gig, but I remember when Roger said, this is for the kids of Cincinnati. You know, I just think, we're in the wrong city. We're in Buffalo, you know. I know what he meant, but I just thought it was dumb, you know. We shouldn't have been performing at all. Not his fault, but you know what I mean. I love Roger, you know, just that was his response. And mine was probably just to drink another bottle of brandy, so not much better. We should have stayed. We should have done the dutiful follow-up of being present and being available to speak and to support the families, and also not just of those who died, but those who had been hurt, because there were a lot of people that were just really badly hurt. And we didn't know anything about this until literally months later when we were subpoenaed to do depositions, which was about insurance, really, most of all, for the families to try to get insurance. And we didn't handle it very well, I don't think. But it's interesting that through that, other musicians, other bands have learned what to do. You know, the other thing about that event is we used to have something called festival seating, which you would go into an arena and you'd have no seats. So it was a big rush to get to the front. So even if you've got seats, you can still have a festival atmosphere, just as long as the security is not too severe. You know, if you don't have people walking up telling people to sit down, as though it's a kind of a Nazi state, they can have a place to go to, a seat, but then they can get up and they can clap and they can even move around if they want to. But that you don't have that rush to the front. So for a long time, we didn't allow festival seating after that at our events. We had to have seats. That's how we were performing at the time. And we stopped doing that straight away. So.
I don't like it.
Survivor Mike Simkin is no longer a fan of festival seating.
I don't like it. They said the festival seating was going away in this town, and it did for a while. And then when they brought it back, I can't help it. It's just the way I feel. There's something that hit me right in the heart. when they brought it back. They say, you know what they say about history? It repeats itself if you don't learn from it. And who knows? Maybe people are, I don't know, maybe things are different now. But I can tell you that festival seating sets itself up for a situation like that. I mean, you know, it creates a setting for another situation to happen like that. Another insanely popular group comes in here, kids fighting for good seats. You know, it makes, at least it opens that possibility back up. And with assigned seating, you know, it may be difficult for people to get good seats all the time, but I can tell you it's safer. I can tell you what the most important thing is, and that's that your kid's going to come home that night.
This happens throughout the world. There are still issues that happen, again, because of the crush of a crowd for a festival seating type event.
Retired Cincinnati Assistant Police Chief Dale Menkhouse fought to keep festival seating out of the city.
25 years later, they reversed themselves. And I wrote multiple letters. I was retired from Cincinnati Police Department at the time, recounting what the issues with festival seating were, but they were pretty much ignored.
Is the band to blame at all?
I don't know. There are those that say the band requests festival seating because they like that crowd right in front of the stage. My opinion is it's all about money. Festival seating, you can pack more people in. If you think that whole arena floor, you could probably put another 3,000 to 5,000 people on that floor over and above the normal seating capacity. So I think it's more about revenue.
Survivor Steve Upton says he doesn't blame festival seating.
You know, festival seating got a lot of the blame, but to me, it was more, they didn't open enough doors. You know, they only opened 4 doors out of the 88. And it was in this, you know, wedge kind of thing, so that just amplified all the 18,000 people. You know, a little push times 18,000 people is a lot of force.
Victim Jackie Ackerley's sisters say they don't blame the band.
But I never did think it was the Who's fault. It had to be people on the ground running things that were managing the Coliseum somehow. Because the Who were doing a gig. They go from town to town, they show up, they do their job, right.
Who singer Roger Daltrey says he never felt responsible.
Was it our fault? I don't know. I don't think it was. But he kind of made the statement, we have to take some responsibility. But I must admit, in my head, I never ever felt any.
Do you wish you hadn't gone on the next day? Is there anything that you wish you could have done?
I don't think we could have done anything different than we did in the end. I don't think it would have helped if we'd stayed. What could we have done? We couldn't have brought them back to life. You know, life goes on. We can't bring them back. They didn't die in vain. Safety was improved at the venues.
Who guitarist Pete Townsend hopes something good has come from that tragedy?
Well, God, one hopes that something good comes out of it. And, you know, the fact that the families and members of the community in Cincinnati have put a foundation and a scholarship and endowment for this is probably one of the nicest things that you could do to remember the people who died and the people that were hurt and traumatized, because it must have been traumatizing as well.
Several Finneytown grads created a living memorial in honor of Stephen Preston, Jackie Eckerly, and Karen Morrison. The annual PEM Memorial Scholarship goes to 3 Finneytown graduates who demonstrate the same passion for music and art that Preston, Eckerly, and Morrison shared. Victim Karen Morrison's cousin, Scott Kirby, told me more about the PEM Memorial.
There were 3 students from Finneytown High School who were killed that night. And PEM represents the first letter of each of their last names. several of their classmates decided, I believe it's been about 10 or 11 years ago now, that they really needed to do something in memory of these kids. That's how it started. I think it was really inherently a way for them to help cope with what had happened as well. They're all adults now, children. They're seeing the same things that you know, these three kids' parents saw in 1979. So it was giving them an opportunity to give back to their friends. And that's how they always refer to them, as their friends. So what they've done is created three scholarships, again, in the three Finneytown students' names, and they award three scholarships each year to a graduating senior who's gonna be pursuing something in the arts, because each of these kids were very arts interested. So they've turned this tremendous tragedy, this horrific event, this life-altering thing into something that they can feel good about, which again I think was the initial catalyst behind it. But I can speak for my family and a few of the other family members that I've met that it helps us a great deal as well. And the only way you can do that is to move on. And that's what they're doing as well. They're keeping these three kids' memories alive. But at the same time, they're moving on. They're helping the families move on. And put some of that to rest, I think.
Victim Stephen Preston's parents appreciate the pen.
I'm glad that he's being remembered and that all three of them are being remembered. And I think it was, whole thing was important historically. And so I think it's good to keep it front and center. I like the fact that they're giving scholarships to kids.
That's great. And some of those kids were there. And it have been the last few. I've attended the last few events.
Yeah, and that's positive.
Yeah.
It's very nice that he's remembered, that it's not just pushed under the rug. And for Jackie and Karen.
The scholarship idea came to light after Finneytown graduates placed a memorial bench right in front of the Performing Arts Center at the school. Later, a beautiful brick plaza was created around the bench, and plaques of the three former students now adorn the wall.
I went to Finneytown last year, and I'm really glad I did, and saw the wonderful work that they do there with their scholarships for the three people they lost at that school. And you have to go forward, and that released a lot for me, and I know it did for our manager, I know it did for Bill Kirbishley, because I did have the chance to thank him in front of the people and parents of who lost. So that helped a lot for us. But the scars are still there. The scars will never go away. They never do, that kind of grief, you know. I think it's like the scars of someone coming home from a war zone. You know, they just sit with you.
Band manager Bill Kirbishley wonders, is it enough?
How do you compensate someone? Money's not enough. And so I've always felt that inadequate, I suppose. I've always felt inadequate in a sense in what we could do for those families. When the memorial was set up and I've been approached on different levels by people there, I've always been absolutely ready to help them and try and do whatever we can. But despite everything, I still feel very inadequate. And for me, I don't know about the guys, but for me, I left a little bit of my soul in Cincinnati.
So here it is, 40 years later. And really, for the first time, you guys are talking about this.
We're talking about it because we've been asked to talk about it. And because it is 40 years, talking about it is definitely a healing process. I think that talking about it here and knowing that it's going to go back to Finneytown, to Cincinnati as a whole, adds another layer for me to the healing process. I think I was healed, except, as I've said to you, I've got a scar. And it's a chip off the soul for me. But I've often said that for me, life is about having scars, and the scars become the strongest part.
And I'd like to say it changed me for the better, but I don't think necessarily that it did. I think it was just one of those things where, you know, it's like a scar that you just have to get used to the fact that you're going to carry it. You know, one of the reasons maybe why the scar has been tricky is because, wow, you know, this is the first conversation in depth that we've had about this ever.
Are you saying to me this is the first in-depth conversation you've had about this?
Yeah. Yeah. The first dedicated conversation about the accident. Yeah. The scoop. No, it is. It's the first one.
What do you say to the people of Cincinnati?
You know, I suppose what I want to say is, you know, shit happens to everybody. You know, I've lost people in my family, and that what we have to do as a group is we have to support each other. You know, and what I think the WHO and their management and their record company and the promoters and everybody involved in it did not do was support the people who were hurt. I don't think they did, and I think our opportunity now is to do that in a very, very simple way, is to come and play, do what we're good at, entertain, and show that we can do it without accidents. And hopefully support the foundation, which is more than, the foundation isn't just a foundation, it's a memorial. So, you know, maybe now the scar will heal a little bit, you know, but I think it requires us to go back and do a show there. I hadn't realized that we just haven't done it. We haven't played there. I don't know whether what actually happens is when the promoter is working out the route, they kind of go, oh, what about Cincinnati? And they kind of go, oh, maybe not. So what I want to say is that we'll be there. You know, I think, you know, we'll be there. And we're talking about trying to do it when we come back to pick up some shows that we lost because Roger was ill in April of next year. So hopefully that will be our target. And having said that, now we'll just have to come. So, you know, I think this concert supporting the memorial and supporting the endowment fund would just be a great way to... It's not going to close the book, though. I'm not trying to close a book here. Do you know what I'm saying? This is not going to change. It's something that I'll surely remember on my deathbed.
But if they wanted to go back, I would be totally 100% behind it, 110% behind it, and would be very emotional. We shouldn't play the same place, obviously, but they've got new venues. And, yeah. And if we went back, I feel that we could also help then the community to heal themselves as well, you know. So, yeah, I'm up for it.
Well, Pete says you're doing it.
Did he? Well, if he said that, I'll do it.
On December 3rd, 2019, exactly 40 years later, I had the honor to announce on WCPO that the WHO would return to the Cincinnati area for the first time since the tragedy. The WHO will perform on Thursday, April 23rd, 2020, at BB&T Arena at Northern Kentucky University. The idea to come back and play one more time, Pete Townsend and Bill Kerbishley told me, was to help them heal and the community finally heal as well. All tickets are for reserved seating.
What would be more appropriate than taking a symphony orchestra and the kind of this slightly more grown-up band back, and just that would be closing a circle for me. You know, we close the show, we end with Barbara O'Reilly, but we close this show with Love Rain on Me, and I can't think of a better way to just reconnect.
The Night That Changed Rock podcast is a production of WCPO in Cincinnati. Visit WCPO.com/The Who for video and more. Produced by Tanya O'Rourke and Hillary Lake. Hosted by Tanya O'Rourke. Written and edited by Brian Neese. Behind Blue Eyes and Love Rain Over Me. Performed by The Who. Courtesy of Polydor Records Limited. Geffen Records under license from Universal Music Enterprises. Written by Pete Townsend.